Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about those flame retardants found in so many products. They can cause metabolic and liver problems. University of New Hampshire. A good night's sleep keeps your stem cells young. Well, that's good. That's from university in Germany and published in Nature magazine. And consuming oily fish. Let's think of sardines as probably the best that you could consume because it's small, hence least polluted. You're not getting them from the Pacific, mainly the Atlantic. Hence, less of the Fukushima radiation. And if you're going to eat fish, the healthiest fish in the world to eat would be the sardine. Well, it can repair the damage to your blood vessels. And almost everybody has damaged blood vessels. University of Reading. Our guest today from the United Kingdom is Joanne Harry. And he is an award-winning journalist and former investigative reporting author from The Independent, and he's reported from Gaza, the Congo, India, Rwanda, Syria, Venezuela. We're going to talk about the failed war on drugs and the need to reevaluate the causes of drug addiction. Also, if time permits today, nutritional strategies to combat Alzheimer's disease. Also, fast-tracking treason and the coming corporate coup. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, a special short report from Rivera Sun, Truth Out. Infant deaths in Alaska, a Fukushima effect, Dr. Jeanette Sherman, medical doctor, and Joseph Mangano. We'll talk about that. And then we'll also look at 25% of all children who are homeless need mental health services, North Carolina State University. Yes and no. I'll tell you the yes and the no and why. And amazing, I saw this not reported in any of the mainstream or alternative media today, but yesterday there was a major coup plot against the Venezuelan government that was foiled, with both civilian and members of the military detained. President Nicolas Maduro talked about this. Could it be that the United States had a hand in it and those involved were being paid in U.S. dollars and one of the suspects had been granted a visa to enter the United States should the plot fail? Why is it that we refuse to look at any of these news stories? And also, how about the Clinton Foundation? Did anyone report on how many millions of dollars it received from proponents of the Keystone XL? Well, Sarah Lesser, we'll talk about that from Common Dreams. You get enough money, you're expected to get something in return. That's always true with the Clintons. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. I remember when I became involved in helping a small group of women in Boston back in the mid-1970s who were advocating for getting rid of the sugar in the commercials on television. Their concern was very legitimate. They said that a lot of children are spending more and more time, especially on the weekends, on Saturday and Sunday, in front of television, especially Saturday, and they had taken the time to look at every single commercial on television in the Boston area for a number of months and found that these foods, snacks, beverages, cereals had so much sugar and artificial coloring and preservatives that it could lead to children being hyperactive and fidgety, gaining weight, having problems with dental caries, etc. And needless to say, they were not given a whole lot of attention by the mainstream media. And now we bring it up till today. Refuse to acknowledge that ADHD and ADD could be due to environmental factors, including the amount of sugar and high fructose corn syrup in those soft drinks and energy drinks and sugared cereals in the morning. refuse to acknowledge that ADHD and ADHD and ADD are either non-existent in most children, but are normally the symptoms of inattentiveness, hyperactivity, drowsiness, are due to lifestyle, staying up late at night, having a cell phone, which adversely disrupts your neurons in the brain, and especially melatonin at night. I know people that actually tell me their kids sleep with their cell phones on under their pillows. Well, there are over 40 studies that show that that's going to lead to brain abnormalities, including cancer. So we can realistically expect within the next 10 years an absolute epidemic of brain cancer or skull cancers, skin cancers, jaw cancers in people who at that point probably be in their teens or 20s. We also would rather just give them a diagnosis, say it's brain chemical imbalance, and that they need Ritalin. Of course, it's not true. Also, many of them are suffering from not full-spectrum conditions like autism, but rather they've had some impact of mercury and aluminum combined in various vaccines that have not caused full-out regression, but have caused little ticks in their behavior. This is from Yale University. Quote, middle school children who consume heavily sweetened energy drinks are 66% more likely to be at risk of hyperactivity and inattention symptoms. This was done at Yale School of Public Health. Quote, an alarming increase in the consumption of sports and energy drinks, especially among adolescents, has been found to cause irreversible damage to teeth and erode tooth enamel. Two research papers, each published separately, suggest that concerns over levels of caffeine and sugar in energy drinks and their effects on young people who drink them are mounting. Okay, here's what they didn't put in here, and I agree with them on this. But what they didn't put is, about 10 years ago, I had a number of parents who came to me, who knew one another, and said, was there anything that could help their kids who were all considered ADD and ADHD and had been diagnosed and they weren't getting better? So we put them on a simple lifestyle modification support group. Once a week for 3 months, the children were brought in, and initially they were just bouncing off the walls. But it was the parent that had to get the message. Here's what you take out of their diets. Here's what you put in. Here's how you can test them. And I had my friend and colleague, Dr. Martin Feldman, board-certified neurologist, and he was there to give the actual protocols and to monitor the children's behavior. Over a period of 3 months, we saw phenomenal changes in those parents who stuck with it. No sugars of any kind, unless they were coming from natural fruits or natural juice, like a glass of orange juice, for example. But nothing artificial, no artificial stimulants at all, no caffeine of any kind. Wholesome foods, start the day with millet, for example, and put some almond butter, cashew butter into it, or pistachio butter, and no dairy, rather some rice milk or almond milk, and lots of vegetables and juices, and every day every child had to have 3 glasses of wheatgrass with ginger in it and lemon. We saw about 90% improvement in all the children who stuck with the protocols. Now, had this been simply a brain chemical imbalance, as they had originally been diagnosed with, then the changes we gave them would not have made a difference. None. But the fact that it did make a difference meant that these kids had been wrongfully diagnosed and had been stigmatized and given medications they did not need. So the message to Yale University is that you are right, and I commend you for doing a good study on energy drinks and hyperactivity and inattention, but what are the two states of being in a school that will get you diagnosed by your teacher first, who is not a medical doctor, and then by the school psychologist, and then by the psychiatrist, and get you on drugs. Hyperactivity and inattentiveness. So you're right on track saying why it happens. Now, you could add in there cell phones and sleeping very little. And as you know, any college student who is cramming and living on caffeine is likely to do worse and end up with defective immune systems and come down with colds and flus because they're very vulnerable, because they haven't had a good night's sleep. Or maybe they're just partying a lot. Same phenomena. And look at the students that don't pay attention in class and are inattentive. So, good study. Just have to look at the results a little differently. They help kids. And by the way, the same is true for adults as well. A new study reveals how resveratrol's heating happens. And I read this with concern because a lot of people don't realize how powerful resveratrol as a nutrient is and what it can do in the body and how beneficial it is. It's just one of nature's most perfect nutrients. It can protect our DNA from damage. That's one of the things that it does. And as it mimics the amino acid tyrosine, and the enzyme TyraRS is activated when bound in resveratrol, which kind of fools the enzymes into moving them to cell nucleus where it can then protect your DNA from damage. In effect, this allows the grapes that you eat, the grape juice, the grape concentrate, the grape powders, it enables the resveratrol to enact much of its anti-cancer and anti-aging effects. So now they know how this works. It lowers your bad C-reactive protein. It also protects your brain. So it's really, really good. And there's been work with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, brain ischemia, even Huntington's, and resveratrol. It's beneficial for all those conditions. Another thing that's beneficial is coconut oil. A good study published in the peer-reviewed journal Applied Physiology, Nutrition, and Metabolism shows that coconut oil and physical exercise improved high blood pressure and oxidative stress in this laboratory experiment. In fact, in this experiment, they were given virgin coconut oil and swimming for 4 weeks, and it made an enormous difference in reducing blood pressure. So, 1 teaspoon of coconut oil in the morning in your smoothie or in a hot cereal will do you a lot of good. For those of you who suffer from thyroid dysfunction, which is probably upwards of 20% of women over the age of 40, you increase your risk of cancer. A new study on this comes, it's from the Open Journal of Endocrine and Metabolic Diseases. Quote, "It is beginning to dawn on some clinicians that contemporary treatments are not only failing to impact on our most prevalent diseases, but they may be causing more damage than good. A perfect example of such an issue is the statin saga." End quote. And scientific evidence clearly shows that statins cause cataracts, acute kidney failure, liver dysfunction, diabetes, muscular degeneration, coronary artery and aortic calcification, erectile dysfunction, and cancer. Why in the world would anyone then want to be taking a statin drug? But also what we're finding simultaneously is for a long time, subclinical hypothyroidism has been associated with a 260% increase in the prevalence of heart disease. In point of fact, multiple other studies have shown a connection between premature death due to cardiovascular disease and underactive thyroid. Now, I have an article that was written with Dr. Martin Feldman, the best physician I know of in the United States when it concerns the thyroid, and it's on posted online, and you can read it. And it was also posted in the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients. And it talked about the T TSH levels. And when they're elevated, you increase the risk of fatty deposits in the arteries, and that increases your risk of having coronary arteries that end up causing heart disease. So what we need to do is we need to get our thyroid checked by a holistic physician, start having more sea vegetables in our diet to get quality iodine, to exercise on a more regular basis, and stay away from the meat-based diet and dairy and do a real good detox. All of that helps your thyroid. And when your thyroid is helped, your whole metabolism is helped. University of New Hampshire, quote, chemicals used as synthetic flame retardants that are found in common household items such as couches and carpet padding and electronics have been found to cause metabolic and liver problems that can lead to insulin resistance, which is a major cause of obesity. So my suggestion is one reason to go through your house or apartment and everything that contains particle boards that are outgassing or carpets with formaldehyde in them, or anything with has a flame retardants, get rid of them. Replace them with more natural materials and lessen the opportunity of this happening. Because once you start getting these flame retardants in the body, you got to do a whole detox to get them out. Can you get them out? Yes, but they're going to do damage while they're in there. A study just published in the journal Nature, scientists at a Heidelberg University and Institute of Stem Cell Technology and Experimental Medicine have uncovered that environmental stress is a major factor in driving DNA damage in adult stem cells. Now, under normal circumstances, many of the different types of tissue-specific adult stem cells, including almost any kind, exist in a state or dormancy where they rarely divide and have very low energy demands. And this study showed that under conditions of stress, like during chronic blood loss or infections or a trauma to the body, that's when there's damage done at the stem cell level. And stem cell damage is serious. So here's what you do. First and foremost, it's all about stressors. Now, that could be a nutritional stressor, eating more than what your body can process. Because there's a relatively small amount of food that the body can process the right way at any given time. This whole idea of gorging till we're full, overeating, a lot of empty calories or saturated calories, that stresses us. Better to eat smaller quantities more frequently. What I call grazing through a day. We have a really good, healthy, full smoothie in the morning with all your essential oils and fibers and polyphenols from fruits and protein from plant-based, whether it's hemp or soy, non-genetically engineered, of course, or rice or split pea. And then later on in the mid-morning, have yourself something to eat, but as a single item. And later, have something else. If you just took some nut butter and put that onto a rice cracker, that would be fine as a snack. Stabilize your blood sugar, gives you essential nutrients, and there's no harm, no downside. Having juices throughout the day, having one really good quality meal, but not huge, reasonable. You should still feel you could eat more when you get up from a table. You should never get up feeling full, because that creates metabolic stress. Being in a polluted environment, environmental stress upon the body's lungs and heart and detox system and liver and glutathione. Emotional stress creates cortisol cascade that really damages stem cells. Over-exercising. Over-exercise, it's worse than under-exercising. you literally prematurely age your body. And the confusion occurs, and it's understandable, because exercise done right is so beneficial. It extends the lifespan. It slows the aging process. It decreases the heart rate, which is what you want. You want a lower beat per minute, ideally in the 50 beats per minute range. They could add another 20 years of life onto your heart. You want to cleanse the intestine, and exercise does that. It helps you speed up peristalsis. You want to get rid of the acid in the body. That helps to do that. You want to create nice feel-good hormones, and the endorphins are released after about half hour of aerobic exercise. All that's good. But you're creating oxidative stress. Therefore, you have to compensate. So before you go out for your workout, you should have your coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E and vitamin C and quercetin and garlic. And that will then compensate for the oxidative stress. Then you get the benefit of exercising, none of the downside. But if you go out there and you just start really hammering it, and going long workouts every day, you're going to now put yourself in a de-stress position physically and be speeding up the whole shortening of the telomeres. Well, if you exercise properly, you lengthen the telomeres. You keep them longer. And the shorter your telomeres become, the closer to senescence or programmed cell death you become. So, for all of you ultra-marathoners, and I was one at one time, for all of you who just keep running long, remember, you only have to do 3 miles a day, 3 miles a day, 6 days a week, or 18 miles, to keep in ideal health. Now, if you're training for a specific race that requires longer, harder training, that's fine. Just compensate. But after that race, pull it back. And not pulling it back, getting into these compulsions, one day you're going to wake up, and though you're only 40, your body's 80. You will burn up your muscles. So I'm just giving that as a warning. Protect your T cells, protect your stem cells, protect all cells in the body and your DNA. And individuals with type 2 diabetes, which is adult diabetes, should exercise after dinner. This is in the University of Missouri. Quote, individuals with type 2 diabetes have heightened amounts of sugars and fats in their blood, which increases their risk of cardiovascular disease, such as strokes and heart attacks. Exercise is a popular prescription for individuals suffering from type 2 diabetes, but little research has explored whether these individuals receive more benefits from working out before or after dinner. Now, research at the University of Missouri has found that individuals with type 2 diabetes can lower their risks of cardiovascular disease more effectively by exercising after a meal. Quote, from the Department of Nutrition and Exercise Physiology, this study shows that it is not just the intensity or duration of exercising that is important, but also the timing of when it occurs. Results of this study show that resistance exercise has its most powerful effect on reducing glucose and fat levels in one's blood when performed after dinner. Okay, good. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's take a moment to offer the best special ever for a nutrient that we make in our own body, but as we age, we don't make enough. And a lot of medical conditions can impact it, and it's coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinone. We believe that we offer as fine a coenzyme Q10 as is available. Normally, it is $60 for a month's supply. For 1 week only, or until supplies are exhausted, I want to offer the best special ever. You're going to buy a case. You cannot buy anything less. One case, 12 bottles. That's a year supply. Normally, it's $720. You're going to pay $240. That's nearly $500 savings. You heard me correct. A year supply of coenzyme Q10 for $240. I'm in the mood to be extremely giving, and you're getting the benefit of it. Coenzyme Q10, It is one of what I consider the top 10 nutrients that we should be taking on a daily basis. And the older we get, the more important it is for us. So you're saving nearly $500, $480 to be exact. It's normally $720 for a year supply, 12 bottles. You're getting 12 bottles for $240. Call now, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. $240 for 12 bottles. 12 months, a year supply for only $240. You save nearly $500. How about that? 877-627-5065.
Nice to have you with us today. We are going to go to our guest in a moment here, and Joanne Harry, to talk about the failed war on drugs and the need to reevaluate the causes of drug addiction. I just want to share a few other things prior to we bring him on. Infant deaths in Alaska. This is nowhere in the media, but it's an important article by Dr. Jeanette Sherman, MD, and Joseph Mangano. A recent article from the Anchorage, Alaska Dispatch News from this week, quote, rash of sleep-related infant deaths troubles health officials, bears consideration. Now, many of the infant deaths are attributable to babies sleeping with parents, alcohol abuse, poor parenting, etc. Notably, the article stated, quote, almost many of the families who suffered a recent baby death were low income. But has infant care and poverty varied as much in the past decade? Infant mortality in Alaska has been falling for years. However, 122 infants died just the last year, compared with 85 2 years before. Research of causes of this highly unexpected increase is needed, and consideration should be given to the arrival of radioactive fallout from Fukushima after the 2011 meltdown. Radiation levels were the highest in Alaska and Hawaii and the Pacific West Coast. Now, since we know the unborn and young are at greater risk from exposure to nuclear radiation, effects that have been documented since the Marshall Islands nuclear test, X-rays of pregnant women in Chernobyl catastrophe of 1986. So according to the CDC, infant deaths in Alaska have been falling steadily, but increased after Fukushima. And so after Chernobyl and significantly in Belarus, data confirmed elevated cesium-137 levels and adverse effects upon the blood, blood vessels, and hearts of children. This research demonstrated the links between the 137 and heart damage in Belarus children. And we know that high and continuing levels of this isotope are being released from the damaged Fukushima plants. And cesium-137, like potassium, becomes deposited in soft tissue. As for the infant deaths in Alaska, we hope that careful and complete autopsies were performed on the dead children and that levels of radioisotopes were measured. Let us see about that. And finally, from North Carolina State University, a study, 25% of children who are homeless need mental health services. Quote, a pilot study at Wake County, North Carolina, finds that 25% of the children who are homeless are in need of mental health services. The study conducted by researchers at North Carolina State University and community action targeting who are homeless highlights the need for more screening and support for the millions of homeless children in the United States. Quote, these children have often been exposed to domestic and neighborhood violence, chronic poverty, inadequate health care, and other circumstances that place any child at risk of mental health problems. As a result of their exposure to those difficult life circumstances, combined with living in a shelter, homeless children are at a much greater risk of developmental delays, social and emotional problems, and problems at school. And the scale of the problem is huge. Yeah, I would say it's huge. We're talking about millions of children. Well, here are my thoughts on it. Why don't they simply do a pilot study, one that would not be difficult nor that expensive? Here's what I was thinking. You take a group of children equally divided, age, background, similar circumstances, similar previous life exposures. You take 100 of them, and you
put them through the normal mental health system within any state. Then you take another 100 and give them a different environment. With their parents, you put them into a holistic rural community. Allow them to have the type of humanistic psychological counseling, but not drugs. And you also allow them to be exposed to nature and animals, so they can befriend a little heifer or a little goat or a little creature that can love them. Let them see how food is grown. Let them see how life evolves in a community that is peaceful, where there's no drug addiction or alcohol, there's no abuse, and there's always some form of holistic support system. Have them there for a year, and then have an independent, non-drug industry affiliated researcher come in and then do evaluation of the 100 in the rural environment and 100 in the state environment and see the outcome. I would be willing to bet that the ones who were given a chance to be near nature and animals and humanistic psychological counseling would be able to evolve, understand the crisis they've gone through, and understand why it wasn't their fault, and not to allow that to be the trauma that epigenetically follows them through life. That is not expensive to do, and I think it's needed. Otherwise, here's the likely outcome of this. You're going to have people saying, yes, we need a village to help these children. Nice political campaign. We have 3 million of these children, 2.7 million are homeless who get out of school each day, plus we have 16 million who are food deprived. They're going to bed hungry. So we need, and we also have not just these, but we also have a lot of 50% of all children right now in the United States. All children are from families that are financially stressed, some in abject poverty, some living on less than $2 a day. So the best way to help these people and to help their future is to see that they get the best psychiatric care, best mental health care. We got to get these kids on drugs. We got to get them on early and got to get them on a lot of them. That way we can see that they don't become mass killers. That's exactly what they intend to do. They want to mental health screen every kid in America so they can put them on meds. Of course, you're going to see skyrocketing homicide and suicide. So there is an alternative. You don't need a village to raise a kid. You just need someone who cares and loves. So that is something that we hope to do. Maybe in the next year or year and a half, if circumstances prevail, I'll help put together such a environment. And we can then set up a test and see what happens with 100 homeless children and their families when you give them that and compare it to a group getting the mental health care. And that's simply medications. Okay, now let's go over and say hello to Mr. Hari. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, great to be with you, Gary. Thanks for having me.
I gave your background a little earlier in the program of all the good work you've done, many awards, Journalist of the Year by Amnesty International for your coverage of the war in the Congo and the Environmental Press Awards for your coverage of Bangladesh in confronting your own drug addiction. You spent 3 years investigating the failures of the current war on drugs and the politicizing of drug addiction, including its economic ramifications. And that resulted in your recent publication, Chasing the Scream. Wonderful title, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And it completely overturns and revises our perceptions about how individuals are impacted by these draconian laws on drug abuse, and its causes are no longer valid. The website, by the way, is chasingthescream.com. So as far back as the Harrison Act in 1914, outlawing heroin and cocaine, The U.S. has been engaged for 101 years in both an official and unofficial war against the drug trade and victims of the drug addictions. Now, similar to the war on cancer, the war on poverty, and the war on terror, the war on drugs continues to be a dismal failure. Why we continue to repeat and increasingly fund a policy that the government has stamped into the social consciousness is beyond reason. And what is certain is that the war on drugs benefits many different parties financially without tackling the real problem of addiction and decreasing drug use. And in my estimation, it is only getting worse. Governments benefit. Private industries, such as the bureaucrats running privatized prisons, benefit. Local law enforcement benefits. And the criminal drug cartels benefit from the criminalization of drugs and drug use. So I'd like you to begin by laying out the intrinsic dysfunction of the structural template upon which the war on drugs is based and why its premises have led to repeated failure. And if the war on drugs is highly lucrative for certain invested parties, why should there be any reason to reevaluate its failures and do away with it altogether? Is it not simply part of the free market agenda? The forum is yours.
Well, when I realized we were coming up to 100 years since drugs were first banned, you know, it's an issue I've been thinking about a lot in my life. One of my earliest memories is of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to, and as I got older, realizing we had addiction in my family. And I thought of myself as a fairly well-informed person, but I realized there were actually loads of really basic questions that I didn't know the answer to, like, why were drugs banned in the first place? Why do we continue having a war on users and addicts when that policy doesn't seem to be working? What do the alternatives really look like? And what really causes drug use and drug addiction? And so I decided to go on a kind of journey to try to find the answers to these questions. And I ended up traveling a long way across 30,000 miles in 9 different countries. And I realized what I wanted to do was to tell the story. I think part of the problem in the way we discuss this issue is we talk about it in such an abstract way. You know, it's like we're at a philosophy seminar and we're arguing about how the world might be. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to see how this policy affects real people in their real lives day by day. So I decided to spend time with lots of different people who, you know, who've been affected in very different ways from the war on drugs, from a transsexual crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, to the only person to ever make it out of the deadliest Mexican drug cartel and live to tell what they're like on the inside, to a scientist who spends a lot of time feeding hallucinogens to mongooses to see what happens, to the only country that's ever decriminalized all drugs from cannabis to crack with incredible results. And what I've found is almost everything we think we know about this subject 100 years in is wrong. Drugs are not what we think they are. Drug addiction is not what we think it is. The drug war is not driven by what we think it is. And the alternatives are not what we think they are. So there's a whole range of things to discuss there.
Well, let's go through that. You tell the story of a drug addict, Marcia Powell, who in 2009 died in an American prison due to cruel torture. What the story reflects is our social attitude.
I went to Arizona, which has one of the worst, which I knew had a bad prison system. And I went to a prison where women are forced to go out on chain gangs wearing T-shirts saying I was a drug addict and made to dig graves. And I went out with this chain gang. When I first went to Arizona, I went and met with an amazing woman called Donna Leone Hamm, who works with... she's one of the very few people in the state who works on prisoners' rights. And I said to her, you know, tell me about something, things that have shocked you in the time you've done this work. It's one of my standard questions. She went down this big, long list, and somewhere down the list, she said, there was the time they put that woman in a cage and cooked her. That was bad. And then she carried on, and I said, sorry, Donna, can you go back a second? There was a woman called Marcia Powell, as you say. All that was known about her when I started researching the book is that she was a chronic meth addict who kept being imprisoned either for having meth or for prostituting herself to get meth. And one morning in 2009, she woke up in Perryville Prison, and she was suicidal. And the doctors refused to believe her, but to shut her up, they took her and they put her in an outdoor... The guards took her and put her in an outdoor cage. And bear in mind, this is the desert. This is Arizona. It's literally just a cage exposed to the desert. And Marcia Powell cried, and she begged for water, and she messed herself, and the guards ignored her. And after a while, she collapsed. And by the time they finally called an ambulance, she had been cooked. No one was ever criminally punished for what was done to Marsha Powell. In the book, I tell the story about about who she really was and the heartbreaking story of her life. But what really struck me about that story is, you know, there's been this very valuable hashtag recently, Black Lives Matter, which I think is great, about the undervaluation of African-Americans' lives and how they can be killed with no consequences in many cases. I think we need to talk about how addicts' lives matter. And, you know, this is an example. The fact that this woman could be brazenly murdered and no one's punished. I open the book with a story, I think, that tells us so much about what the drug war is really about. It's the story of how Billie Holiday, the jazz singer, was stalked and killed by the founder of the war on drugs. In 1939, not very far from where I'm sitting now in New York, Billie Holiday stood on stage and she sang the song Strange Fruit, which your listeners will know is a song against lynching. And you've got to understand how shocking this was at the time. Billie Holiday wasn't even allowed to walk through the front door of that hotel because she was African-American. She had to go through the service elevator. But she stands up and she sings a song against lynching at a time when almost all pop songs were like twee love songs. And that night, she gets told, according to her biographer, Julia Blackburn, by the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, basically, stop singing this song. The Bureau of Narcotics was run by a man called Harry Anslinger, who's the founder of the modern war on drugs, and probably the most influential person who no one's ever heard of. He takes over the Department of Prohibition just as alcohol prohibition is ending, and he has to find a new purpose. And he's really driven by two strong hatreds. One is a hatred of addicts, and the other is a hatred of African-Americans. And to him, Billie Holiday is the symbol that everything that's going wrong in America. You've got an African-American woman who's resisting white supremacy, and she's a heroin addict. She's a heroin addict she's trying to deal with. Just like Marsha Powell, the woman who's cooked in the cage, she had been prostituted when she was a child. She was trying to cope with grief and pain. But Billie Holiday had grown up in segregated Baltimore when she wasn't allowed in a lot of stores because she was African-American. And she had promised herself as a little girl she was never going to bow her head to any white man. So when they told her to do this, she effectively said, screw you, I'm going to carry on singing my song. And she did carry on singing her song, and that's when Anslinger starts having her stalked. He hated employing African-Americans, but you couldn't really send a white guy into Harlem to stalk Billie Holiday. It'd kind of be obvious. So he employed a guy called Jimmy Fletcher to follow her around. And Jimmy Fletcher got to know Billie Holiday, and he basically fell in love with her because she was such an amazing person. His whole life he felt ashamed of what he did to her. He busts her. She's put on trial. She said, you know, the trial was called the United States versus Billie Holiday, and that's how it felt. She went to prison. And when she gets out of prison, just like the women I met in that jail in Arizona, she's not allowed to, she can't get a job anywhere. She couldn't, you needed a license to perform in order to sing. And you could be denied that license. And they did deny it to her. So, you know, her friend Yolanda Bavan said to me, what's the cruelest thing you can do to a person is to take away the thing they love. They took away singing from Billie Holiday, just like we take away work from addicts everywhere in America. And Billie Holiday, of course, in that situation, relapses. When she's in her early 40s, she collapses here in Manhattan. She's taken to hospital. The first hospital refuses to take her because she's an addict. The second hospital takes her, but Billie Holiday was convinced that Anslinger and the narcotics agents weren't finished with her. She said, they're going to kill me in there. Don't let them. They're going to kill me. The agents handcuff her to the bed, even though they know she's dying of liver cancer. They don't let her friends in to see her. One of her friends manages to insist that she's given methadone because she realized that Billie Holiday would have gone into withdrawal, which is very dangerous when you're so weak. Billie Holiday starts to physically recover when she's given methadone. Then they abruptly cut off the methadone and she dies. But I think what really helped me in thinking about, so I think we see lots of things in this story. We see what the drug war was about then and is about now. It's about cracking down on African Americans. We all know the figures about how African-Americans are no more likely to be drug users or drug dealers than anyone else, but they make up the overwhelming majority of people who go to prison for it. We also see how the drug war makes addiction worse. It takes people who are suffering and makes them suffer more and think that that will make them stop, which is crazy. But also, I think we see the heroism of Billie Holiday. You know, her friend Annie Ross, the jazz singer, said to me that Billie Holiday wasn't weak. Billie Holiday was as strong as she could be. And that really helped me because I've got addicts in my life, and anyone who's got addicts in their life, if they're honest, no matter how liberal they believe drug policy should be and compassionate, you can be angry a lot of the time. And it's really striking to me to realize there are these stories of addicts who can be heroes. And all over the world, because of the courage of Billie Holiday, you know, people are listening to her songs right now and feeling stronger. And that's an extraordinary achievement. And I think her model of resistance and the resistance that I saw all over the world is really points to the way out of the drug war.
I appreciate that insight. I'm sure many people listening right now do not know all that. People are prescribed opiates and heroin derivatives in the United States all the time, and for extended periods of time in many cases, and this does not cause addiction. And some of this prescribed heroin is more pure and would be assumed to be more addictive than anything found in the streets today. So clearly there is evidence that challenges the biochemical model for drug addiction. Other studies you speak about also indicate there is a strong environmental factor that contributes to whether a person will be addicted to drugs or not. So what are some of the more compelling research that you observe should challenge our beliefs about the causes for drug addiction?
This really startled me. I'm glad you asked about this, because this really startled me, and I didn't know about it when I started researching the book. If you had said to me 4 years ago, what causes drug addiction? I would have, let's say heroin. What causes heroin addiction? I would have looked at you like you were a little bit simple-minded, and I would have said heroin causes heroin addiction. We've been told a story about addiction for 100 years now that is so obvious to us it's become part of our common sense. The first thing that alerted me to the fact that what we think is, if you, me, and the next 20 people who walk past your studio, if we all used heroin together, we think because there are chemical hooks in heroin, our body will physically need the heroin at the end of it, and that's what addiction is. The first thing that alerts me to the fact that may be something wrong with that story is, as you say, if anyone listening to this steps out into the street after listening to it and gets hit by a car and breaks their hip, they'll be taken to hospital, and it's very likely they'll be given a lot of diamorphine. Diamorphine is heroin, right? It's much better heroin than you'd score on the streets because it's medically pure as opposed to the stuff dealers sell, which is contaminated. You'll be given it for quite a long period of time. Anyone listening to this, there is a hospital near you giving loads of people heroin. If what we believe about addiction is right, what should happen? Those people should leave hospital as addicts. You will have noticed that virtually never happens. Your grandmother was not turned into a heroin addict by her hip operation. Something else is going on here, and I didn't really know what to do with that discovery until I talked to a guy called Bruce Alexander, an extraordinary man. He's a professor in Vancouver. And he explained to me the idea of addiction we have comes from a series of experiments that were done earlier in the 20th century. They're very simple experiments. Any of your listeners, if they're feeling a little bit sadistic, can do this at home. You get a rat and you put it in a cage and you give the rat two water bottles. One is just water and one is water laced with heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will almost always prefer the drugged water and almost always kill itself through overdose quite quickly. So there you go, that's our theory of addiction. In the 70s, Bruce Alexander comes along and says, hang on a minute, we're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do except use the drugs. Let's do this differently. So Bruce built Rat Park. Rat Park is like heaven for rats. Anything a rat could want, it's got in Rat Park. It's got loads of nice food. It's got loads of colored balls. It's got loads of friends. It can have loads of sex. Anything a rat wants is there. And they've got both the water bottles, the drugged water and the normal water. But here's the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, they don't like the drug. None of them ever use it in a way that looks compulsive. None of them ever overdose. And there's an interesting human example I can tell you about in a second that was happening at the same time. But what Bruce says is this tells us that both the right-wing theory of addiction and the left-wing theory of addiction are wrong. The right-wing theory of addiction is it's a moral failing. You're a hedonist. You indulge yourself too much. The left-wing theory is your brain is hijacked, you're taken over. Bruce says, it's not your morality, it's not your brain, it's your cage. Addiction is an adaptation to your environment. And there's a really interesting human example of this, as I say. At the same time that Bruce is doing the Rat Park experiment, the Vietnam War is going on. And in Vietnam, 20% of American troops are using heroin regularly. And if you look at the news stories from the time, there's this real panic that people think, my God, these people are going to come, you know, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the United States because they believe that old theory. Actually, what happened? They came back and virtually all of them just stopped. They didn't go to rehab, didn't go through withdrawal, they just stopped. Because if you're taken out of a hellish, pestilential jungle where you don't want to be and you could be killed at any moment, and you go back to a nice life in Wichita, Kansas with your friends and your family, you don't want to be out of it, you know. I mean, you think about, set aside the drug laws, you and me, right? We could be drunk now, right? We could be, I've got a bottle of water here, it could be vodka. It's not because I've got something I want to do. I've got things I want to be present for in my life. I've got people I want to be present for. The same is true, you know, with addicts. And this, it's very interesting, in case all this sounds a bit abstract to people, there's a country that has acted on this insight in such an interesting way. In the year 2000, Portugal had one of the worst drug problems in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, which is mind-blowing. And every year they tried the American way more and more. They arrested more people, they cracked down on more people, they put more people in prison, and every year the problem got worse. So the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition got together and said, we can't carry on like this, we've got to do something different. So they decided to set up a panel of scientists and doctors and judges to figure out what would genuinely solve the problem. And they agreed in advance that whatever the panel recommended, they would do. So just took it out of politics. And the panel came back, and they said, decriminalize everything, from cannabis to crack. But, and this is the crucial next step, take all the money we currently spend on making addicts suffer and cutting them off, and spend all that money instead on reconnecting addicts with society. So partly that was things like rehab and the things that we think of as drug treatment. But much more, it was subsidized jobs and subsidized loans for addicts so they could set up businesses. So say you used to be a mechanic, they will go to a garage when you're ready and they'll say, if you employ this guy for a year, we'll pay half his wages. Very simple model. And it's, the idea was to make sure that every addict in Portugal wakes up like you wake up and I wake up with something to do that day, with a purpose and meaning in life. And, you know, it's been 15 years and the results are really striking. Injecting drug use is down by 50%, 50%. Every study shows addiction is down, overdose is massively down, HIV transmission among addicts is massively down, things like street crime fell. One of the ways you know it worked so well is I went to interview a man called Juan Figueira, who led the opposition to the decriminalization, he was the top drug cop in Portugal at the time. And he said a lot of the things that, you know, a lot of your listeners will be thinking, surely if you decriminalize all drugs, there'll be a huge increase in drug use and disaster. And what he said to me was, I'm paraphrasing exact words here in the book, but he said, everything I said would happen didn't happen. And everything the other side said would happen did. And he talks about how he felt ashamed that he'd spent 20 years arresting and harassing drug users. And he hoped the whole world followed Portugal's example. And one of the things I most want people to understand is this is not an abstract conversation. There are countries that have moved beyond the drug war, and it has been an enormous success. And we can choose that path if we want to.
Well, we're out of time. We've actually gone a little longer today because I wanted to get these very important and salient points out. And I thank you very much. Please send a copy of your book to Bill O'Reilly. unfortunately,
good
Bill,
luck with that.
It's not his fault.
The website. It's chasingthescream.com. Yeah.
Okay. poor Bill wasn't born when he should have been. He should have been born in 1296. He could have helped lead the first Inquisition. Thank you very much for your book. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good day. Thanks.
Joanne Harry, H-A-R-I. And the book is a very important book for all of us in Chasing the Scream. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening.
I look forward to sharing more on the next program.